Hey everyone, it is December 4th, 2016. It's episode 71. And with me, as always, are Megan Arnes.
Hello.
And Laurel Black.
Hi.
Ben Charles with his new mic.
Hi, everybody.
Laurel, you look wiped out. Have you been doing something interesting today?
Yeah, I did. I ran my first half marathon today.
Yay!
I'm proud of myself. Yay!
And so I sat on the side miles. And drank hot chocolate in the cold.
Yeah. Has anyone else run a half marathon or a marathon?
Lord, no.
No.
Brandon? Yeah, no. Me neither.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out where Casey was in that photo.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. You kept up to date? Yeah.
No, it's funny. I can totally see myself doing another half, but after finishing it, I was like, there's no way I would ever do a full marathon. No way. I don't know how people do that. That's crazy.
No.
So it is episode 71, and that's, of course, a big deal. But also, it's probably the day's going to go down as the season finale of Westworld is probably how you'll all remember this day. So anyway, pretty excited about that tonight. Our guest today is a section percussionist with the Lexington Philharmonic and newly appointed percussion instructor at the Center College in Danville, Kentucky. He sits on the PAS Education Committee and really has this amazing blog. I hope you guys will check out brandonarve.com. I love your blog, dude. It's just, I don't know, it's full of so many different types of things. So anyway, welcome to the show.
No, thank you guys for having me. Yeah. And, you know, actually, Casey, if we could talk about that at some point, the blog thing, maybe weave that into some of the stuff we talked about before. But, yeah, you know, the blog itself is it's kind of a hodgepodge of stuff, as you can kind of see. I started using it kind of just as a motivator for myself to get into writing, because that was something that, you know, I kind of thought of my skill sets that I had and didn't have. And that was one area that I wanted to improve. And if you happen to know Jeff Goins, that writer, he does a lot of stuff on how to be a writer. Anyway, I follow him and get some email updates from him every so often. And he just talks about, you know, how to get into writing. Pretty much all it is go do it. I mean, there's nothing too special about it. You know, you want to start writing, go do it. And so that's what I kind of did with the blog at first. You know, the earlier ones kind of seem... at least to me, maybe a little all over the place, to be honest with you, in the writing style itself. But I really did want to make it something that was educating educators, mm-hmm. because a lot of people, you know, they want to write content for students. And for me, I like to have, I don't know the right way to say this, mass appeal, or try to have some sort of influence to a greater audience and not just necessarily the people that I can, you know, be in a room with. And so I think, you know, a lot of our educating our students has to be done through educating the people that are, you know, in their classroom teaching them. I don't know if that makes sense, but.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So anyway.
Well, I on the topic of blogs, I wanted to share something. Whenever Laurel reads a book, she always holds up the book and she says, "I just read this book." But I read books on my iPad, so I can't do that. But I just read a book by Walter Isaacson called "The Innovators," and it's about basically the development of the digital age. And one of the things it talks about in that book is blogging. And I guess this isn't really super percussion related, so I'll make it brief. But it's interesting that, like, blogging came out of sort of the same perspective of academia as making just free information available to everyone, where, you know, in academia we do research and we share that freely with everyone. Obviously, with blogging, you have to be somewhat careful because anyone can blog and the content can be garbage, which Brandon's is not, I'm happy to report. But but this book, it's called The Innovators. Like I said, it's a really interesting read on the development of the digital age, if you're curious.
Yeah, I think blogging is a cool way to get, you know, Casey and I were talking at PASIC, like, kind of how this would go and, you know, what did we maybe want to talk about. And, you know, I'm kind of a young gun out of the gate, you know, just finishing a DMA about a year and a half, 2 years ago. So, trying to find my way in the world, you know, trying to find the legs and that kind of thing. I think blogging is a really nice way to do that, you know?
Yeah.
It's a good way to get noticed, a good way to put your thoughts down.
It's also useful when you come across something like, who is it in Nexus that's really into blogging?
Isn't that Bill?
Bill? Yeah, I think it's Bill, yeah.
Yeah.
Bill Kahn has a blog, and he has a whole kind of perspective on, like, homemade instruments. And some of his instruments he's made are really well made. And like, I kind of was inspired by that. I did a couple on like table music tables, how to make those and all. And it's always convenient when you come across someone else's experience with something like a homemade instrument, you can use their trial and error instead of doing your own.
Ben, yeah. You sound so amazing.
That Thanks. Mic is just terrific.
I'm going to keep saying this every couple of minutes. I'm going to bring this back up.
I'm actually quitting percussion. I'm just going to sing opera through this mic.
I think you could do it. I mean, as long as you have that mic. You know, Brandon,
do it.
I was going to say your blog, I love that. I mean, I think even we struggle with this podcast to keep our target audience one thing. And not that you should necessarily just have one target audience, but it's always very nebulous, I feel like. Sometimes we're talking to students, sometimes we're talking to retired musicians, sometimes we're talking to musicians right where we are teaching, and I don't know, somehow, and even on this blog, you like know exactly what you're getting. Okay, it's interview-based, and there's going to be these topics, and you kind of know what to expect, but even then, we still have a hard time anticipating what we're going to get out of every episode, mm-hmm. But your page is really nice. There's all these different things, but I don't feel like, oh, what's the focus? What exactly is this page about? It's just it's laid out very clearly. No, it's about all these different things.
Well, good. I'm glad that comes across. I mean, it's taken a few years to even get to this point, and I know I have a long way to go as far as, you know, nailing down exactly my voice and what I want to get across, you know. If you kind of click through the site, you might see some different things. Like, I think I have a line of what I called like today's lesson, where I was just kind of taking things that I learned while I was teaching, you know, about myself or how I approach something in a totally different way I never thought I would. And I would just kind of pass that along, you know, like, oh, here's this experience I had in teaching a student today. So maybe that could help you. And so I put that on there and try to give it somewhat of a title of a focus. You know what I mean? There was a time like last year where I was kind of getting into the multi-percussion history thing just for a minute and then decided to put a thing on there as what I was trying to make a multi-percussion series, but then life happened and I didn't even try to focus on that anymore. But again, you know, just trying to put things down that interest myself. That I think could help others. So it does seem a little nebulous sometimes about like, well, here's this thing and then here's this other thing in here. But I hope, like what you said, I hope it all does kind of come clearly together as educating educators.
Do you have sort of a release schedule or obligation for yourself as far as how often to post?
Well, going back to this guy, Jeff Goins and others, and like Seth Godin, who I brought up to you before, who's got an amazing output of books, even one called Tribes that maybe we'll talk about later. But, you know, they just talk, these are professional writers that make their money writing and going around telling you how to write as well. And they always advise that you try to do it, you know, every day if you can. You know, SethGodin.com, if you guys are interested to go check him out. He does a blog every day, and sometimes it's a one-sentence thing. Sometimes he gets really inspired and it could be, you know, looks like half a novel almost. And it's on any sort of topic. And to answer your question, I try to do some of that. You know, I try to become better about writing on a regular basis just so I can put things down and not heavily edit it, but just kind of go with the flow, put it out there, press enter and be done with it. There was a time where I did try to make it a weekly thing. You know, because I was seeing like Rob Knopper was going out there, Will James, they were doing it every like Monday or something like that. Which is a cool little regimen, you know, like you hold it, you put it in your schedule. We're all very busy people where you can just say, okay, I'm going to blog for about 20 minutes. I would love to get back to that, you know, doing it once a week, something like that. Right now, if you go look, I have a couple posts here in the past few months, but this semester's been pretty crazy, so it hasn't been regular.
How did you learn about how to do the tech stuff? And did you just learn around along the way? And also, what service do you use to host your webpage, your blog?
Actually, I'm very fortunate. My uncle is a I don't know his exact title, but if you're familiar with Keller Williams Realty, it's like the largest real estate company in the world now.
Wow, big shot. That's what that's called.
Is that your uncle?
That is not him. No, no. He and his wife are both real estate agents and a two-person team, and he does sort of the IT side, and she does a lot more of the FaceTime, going to the properties with clients. And anyway, so since they joined Keller Williams a few years ago, he's been kind of rising the IT side of things. So he's given me host space on his stuff. So I don't really deal with that side, which I'm very fortunate and thankful to him for that. But I do use WordPress. I went and I tried to find a theme that I could buy. I don't really like the cookie cutter looking website. And I think if you look at my blog, it doesn't look cookie cutter at all.
It doesn't.
And so, you know, I tried to get something that was in line with a lot of other popular websites that people like to go to. And I tried to figure out, you know, what exactly is important in that website. You know, something like BuzzFeed, you know, just the visual appeal, or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the brevity of how they put some stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
I try to mix all of those kind of things together into my own sort of voice, and that kind of became the site. I mean, I don't really do any coding because I don't have to, because I went out and I bought a theme. Coding being, you know, going in and doing all this sort of, you know,
the
designing
stuff.
Yeah, all the cascading style sheet kind of stuff. I don't have to do any of that because it's built in.
I like that you even have to explain what coding is nowadays regarding websites. That's pretty amazing.
No, I did. I took computer science in my undergrad instead of math, which was awesome. So for some reason, I guess they figured like musicians really didn't have to buckle down and take a calculus course or something. So I took computer science for 2 semesters in place of a math credit. Which I've since forgotten everything that I learned in there. So that's why I have a template that I bought.
That's interesting, though. I mean, like, I would have never thought to take computer science amongst all the stuff that you're required to take. So that's kind of cool that you can take it in place of something.
Yeah, I took something that interested me more than math. So
my father's a mathematician, and he listens to this podcast every Thursday morning like a good father. And so I jump at any opportunity to say,
sorry, Dad,
I dislike math and how much we all dislike it. So thank you.
No problem. I'm glad I can back you up on that.
Hey, Ben, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Can you just say something into that new mic?
Casey Cangelosi.
That's perfect. That's good. That's good. Hey,
there's such depth there.
I know. You hear that rich, buttery voice that I'm sure.
Next.
Next. All right. Hey, so Ben, why don't you? We haven't touched your historical segment for a long little while, and I've heard at least one person say they've missed it. So why don't you hit us with?
Have you guys seen that? I think it's Jimmy Kimmel has this bit on his show where he has what's a celebrity on like every single time, and they never get to him, and they always cut him off at the end.
Oh, it's Matt Damon.
Matt Damon, that's who it is.
And he loses his shit one episode. Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, that's how I'm starting to feel about my segment. But anyway, so today we're finally
like to
getting
see your
to
reaction.
It really.
Matt Damon is no Ben Charles.
He doesn't sound this good.
Definitely not.
So I had a question I was going to ask you guys, but you guys already know the topic, so it's not going to work. But if you could play dumb for me, what do Paul McCartney, Chick Corea, and Nexus all have in common?
Neil Peart all played drums for them.
No, wrong. Steve Gadd has performed with all of them. I get on these soapboxes in my lessons where I'll be talking to a student and I'll say, you know, have you ever listened to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony? And they say no, and I just pitch a fit. So I had a lesson a few weeks ago, and we were talking about the Garibaldi book, and somehow Steve Gadd came up, And the student had never heard of Steve Gadd, and I was just like furious. So I gave him this huge listening assignment. So anyway, today I'm doing anyone listening a favor by informing them about Steve Gadd, if you're not familiar, which everyone totally should be. So Steve Gadd is sort of one of the most legendary drummers of the past few decades. I guess I'll just give the background on him and then tell you who he's performed with. He was born April 9th, 1945, in a suburb of Rochester, New York. When he was 7 years old, his uncle encouraged him to take drum lessons, so he started doing that. Additionally, as a child, he studied tap dance, and he attributes his sort of ability to get the rhythms into his feet through tap dance as one of his influence in playing drums. By the age of 11, he was a very advanced drummer, and he had actually already sat in with Dizzy Gillespie. When he was 14 years old, he met John Beck, who was teaching at Eastman School of Music, of course, where Megan Arns went to school. He met John Beck, and John Beck sort of took him under his wing, and he started studying with John Beck as a teenager. His early influences were Buddy Rich, Elvin Jones, Tony Williams, and Rick Murata. Buddy Rich was actually also a tap dancer, if you didn't know that. So when he graduated high school, he went to Manhattan School of Music for 2 years, and then he ended up transferring to Eastman. He finished college in the late 1960s and started playing regularly with Chuck Mangione and his brother Gap Mangione. It was at this point that he was drafted into the U.S. Army and spent most of his 3 years in the Army with the Jazz Ambassadors, which were like the top jazz ensemble in the military bands. Then following that military service, he began traveling between Rochester and New York City to play with his own trio and do some studio work. And on the Bill Kahn episode, it was actually interesting. Bill talked about this period, and he said that even Steve Gadd kind of didn't get noticed immediately, like by the larger, I guess, musical community. But finally, in the 1970s and 80s, his career took off. He started performing with Chick Corea, as well as touring and performing with Paul Simon. In 1976, he formed the group Stuff with some other New York City studio musicians. Recently, he's been doing all sorts of projects with the marimba player Mika Yoshida. In 2005, he was awarded an honorary doctorate from Berklee College of Music. And that same year, he was also inducted into the PAS Hall of Fame. If you're curious for more info about Steve Gadd, he has a great website with all sorts of quotes from mentors and colleagues and people who have kind of looked up to him throughout the years. My favorite one, I think, was from Chick Corea, who said, "Every drummer wants to play like Gadd because he plays perfect. He has brought orchestral and compositional thinking to the drum kit while at the same time having a great imagination and a great ability to swing." Some of the other quotes on that website are from John Beck, Peter Erskine, and Buddy Rich. And just to kind of summarize how impressive and diverse Steve Gadd is as a drummer, I have a short list of just some of the people that he's performed with throughout the years. So my list goes B.B. King, Chick Corea, Steely Dan, Simon & Garfunkel, Eric Clapton, James Brown, who I found it really interesting that James Brown would hire a white drummer, Milt Jackson, Frank Sinatra, John Bon Jovi, Al Jarreau, Paul McCartney, Chuck Mangione, Al Di Meola, James Taylor, Joe Cocker, and Nexus.
Woo! That's not short. So,
yeah.
Yeah, you can probably go a ways longer even, too, right?
Yeah, I mean, just unbelievable, incredible musician. And part of the reason that I really started to research him was there was about 2 years ago, I guess, I saw a trailer, I think it was on Vimeo, for a documentary called About Time. And someone's producing this documentary with all these great musicians. There were some interviews with Paul Simon and James Taylor on there about Steve Gadd. And it seems that maybe the documentary has run out of funding and it's not going to be produced anymore or something like that, which really bummed me out because it looks like a super cool project.
Huh. I got a job for you.
Yeah.
Raise some funds.
Quit the podcast, make a documentary about Steve Gadd.
Microphone back if you quit the podcast. Do you hear me?
I guess you've all seen the tap dancing, Steve tap dancing with Nexus.
Yeah, if you look for Nexus performed in Tokyo, I think in 1984 or something like that. They play Xylophonia and Bill Kahn takes his duck call solo and Steve Gadd tap dances on it. It's pretty awesome.
Amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess when John Beck was still teaching at Eastman, Steve would come in and do a masterclass every year. And there's one room at Eastman that is kind of that nobody has keys to, except one person, with a bunch of drums that Steve has donated to the school. Yeah, I guess he continuously does that. So that's really cool that he supports Eastman in that way.
Yeah.
Wow. Are those drum sets that are free for the studio to use, or are they?
No, it's just I've never been in that room before. I don't know, but I just know that there's like a bunch of Steve Gadd's drums in that room. So I don't know if it's collector's items or if it's things that he's gotten from sponsors he doesn't use anymore. I'm not sure. I mean, I know that we've pulled some things out of there before, but I've never actually been in there. I don't know the contents of the room.
I bet it's a hidden university cult, you know, one of those hidden societies of drumming or something.
He's also, the one interesting thing to me about Steve Gadd is he's one of those people that has played on like the same company's instruments for decades now. He's played Yamaha drums and Zildjian cymbals forever. and he has, I mean...
Yamaha's a great company.
Yeah, and he has just this, like, it's not only is he playing on wonderful instruments, but just his approach, he makes such amazing sounds out of these instruments and so musical. I would say definitely my favorite drummer.
Why don't we tap dance anymore? Like, why is that not
I was thinking about that too.
You know, it's like my parents grew up in Pittsburgh in the 70s and stuff. And it's like Lynn Swann and all those famous wide receivers would take ballet.
Yeah.
In fact, I believe Lynn Swann was in my mom's ballet classes when she was there.
You know, I was just, I was just in Virginia like 2 weeks ago, and Casey actually showed me his tap dancing. I don't know if Laurel's ever seen this, but maybe Casey should show us his tap dancing right now.
Yeah, cool. I'll edit it in.
I would love to see that right now.
Trust me. You'll probably just see some feet, but trust me, it's me. It's not something I just screen captured from YouTube. It's me.
You don't it's going to be feet. Office. I thought it might just be a giant middle finger on the screen.
I know. I'm not savvy. If this was Google Hangouts, I'd know how to do that, but I'm not savvy enough with Skype to do that yet. Yeah. Well, wait a minute. People probably, I mean, there's still, you can still study tap, right? Like that's still, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, like you have people in one profession that kind of, they go into elements of another to influence what they do professionally. Like I was saying with football, a lot of them used to take ballet so that they would be more limber and, you know, be able to jump and do these certain moves. And, you know, if tap was such an influence, so in many of our influential drummers' lives, why don't we do any of that? You know, if we're trying to emulate what they do, well, really do it.
Yeah, and it's funny to me. I think that maybe because, like, public schools now make a big deal out of everything. Like, if you're in chess club, it's this huge thing, and you do a lot of chess club or whatever. And again, kind of reading that the Innovators book I was talking about, it seems so tragic to me that, like, kids that join band now, they're just like stuck in band. They don't do stuff other than band. And I think that if you're not allowing outside influences on your music, you're doing something incorrectly.
I hear a segue.
Well, you know, Megan just is showing off her knowledge in the chat right now of little pictures that I will learn to do shortly. But one of them is a boxer. And, you know, my dad, I think I've told you guys, he was a basketball player for LSU when he was in college there. And so he still follows sports. He's a big fan of sports. And I remember when the big fight between Evander Holyfield and Mike Tyson was going to happen. And of course the big thing where Mike Tyson bit Evander Holyfield's ear twice. Do you guys remember that? And he took a chunk out of his ear. But I remember leading up to that, my dad would talk about how much training has changed and how I don't remember him saying specifically there was this cross discipline with, you know, say like football and like you said, tap dancing. But he did say it's really changed a lot and it's very like scientific now what they do and how they built Evander Holyfield was a much different process at this point in his career because he was just massive at that time. And I remember my dad thinking like, yeah, he's probably going to beat Mike Tyson. All that stuff you guys are doing is way distracting, but I'm glad you're doing it.
Well, I would be curious that just thinking about the clear benefits that these great drummers received from doing something like tap dancing, it almost seems like it's less of tap specific and more of just doing something that really integrates your mind and your body together in a rhythmic, coordinated way.
Sure. In a very different way.
And going along with that, like obviously the rhythms in tap dancing aren't all that different, if different at all, from the things that we play with our hands. But I think the way you're perceiving those rhythms is so different, because tap dancers, as to my knowledge, don't count one diana, two anda, you know. And I hate that. Like, people seem to get so caught up in counting all the time, as my, I don't know, my students do anyway.
Yeah. Well, when I was in high school, I did band and choir and swimming, and we did 42nd Street when I was a senior, and so we all had to learn how to tap dance. So I had like 6 weeks to learn how to tap dance, and it was amazing. Kind of like you say, Ben, our teacher would be like 5, 6, 7, 8. And then they would just like call out these names. And I would kind of in my brain, I was like, okay, this is actually 1 and a 2 and 3 e a 4 flam, I would like translate it all in my brain. And, it was kind of fun. Like, yeah, not surprisingly, I think any percussionist that would try it would probably catch on really fast.
I'd imagine that would help like soloing or something too. Get your brain out of like the technical side of music and maybe just be more organic with it, you know?
Yeah. I had never like taken a dance class before. I went to Ghana, and in Ghana, at least the center I was studying at, you cannot just study drumming or just study dancing. Like, everyone has to do both. And at first it was funny to see the drummers or the percussionists like, oh, I don't really want to do that, or, you know, have a hard time picking it up, or whatever. It was interesting to see the process, and then the same for the dancers as well. But I ended up learning so much by learning both. And now I exactly what you said, Laurel, like whenever I'm dancing, I'm like thinking rudiments sometimes, like in West African dance from Guinea and Mali, a lot of times there are like paradiddles. So I'm always like, okay, right paradiddle here, left paradiddle here. And it really helps me remember what comes next in the dance moves. It's funny. But they really are integrated, especially in West African music. And I'm sure the music of many other cultures as well. But you really you're able to understand the music better by learning the dance also, and vice versa.
Well, speaking of this cross-discipline thing, Brandon, you had said earlier that you've done some looking into or some exploration with the other skills musicians need to know other than how to play their instrument. And we've certainly mentioned this on the podcast before, but it sounds like you've got some more substance to add to this this idea.
Well, I don't know if it's really anything groundbreaking. I mean, you know, like, we all have sort of come out into the world and figured out like the skills that we need to get, and we've kind of figured out how to get them. But I think, in a way, I feel like music education is slightly, or could be slightly different now, or maybe should be, or something like that. But, you know, like if you go into a high school or middle school band room, you know, it's all about the music and the technical side of things, and not really about what it is to be a professional musician today, which a lot of times being a professional musician today is all that entrepreneurship stuff, you know, marketing yourself. You know, you talked about my blog, you know, to get me on this podcast takes a certain amount of, you know, communication and skill and whatever else you want to call it.
Yeah, right.
You know, you're talking about technology and being able to make this podcast happen, you know what I mean? Or to record yourself. I have a sort of cheat sheet that I sort of made before, but like technology, composition, improvisation, marketing, communication, all these fun things that I know we all kind of know that we need to know, but I think that we learn it passively today. And I wonder if we should be learning it more actively in a band room, you know? Like a band director, for example, has a lot going on, or even a percussion professor, you have a lot going on. You're teaching classes, you're trying to do your own performing, you're on committees, you have families, you got all this stuff going on that kind of gets in the way of, doing 100% of everything at the highest level that you possibly could. And, There was actually a thing on Facebook this week, or last week, I think it was, where somebody posted a question on the university percussion professor's page or whatever it's called, asking, like, how do you get students to get these experiences to learn how to market and do some of this stuff. And it's like, by doing it, you know. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times professors get hung up on, like, well, they have their job and they don't want the students to do some of that stuff because, oh, it's my job to do that. And I think that's a missed opportunity for students a lot of times, you know, like, it's something as simple as creating the program for the upcoming concert or having a voice in, you know, what are we going to program on this concert that's coming up, or making the posters, or being the person that goes and talks to the event site to coordinate the dates and the times, load in, load out. You know, if you're going to make an event out of it, somebody has to go buy some drinks and coffee and take care of that kind of, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like there's this whole hidden side of what actually we do, not just as, you know, college teachers or something like that, but as professional performers or composers or whatever it might be. There's this whole hidden side that we never really talk about and students don't really get to see unless they're really paying attention or they ask. I know that was like one incredible thing that was sort of provided to me when I came to Kentucky for a doctorate was, you know, Jim Campbell, you know, it's his thing. It's creating opportunities for his students. And I think that's why he's had such immense success in graduating students, especially those that continue on to teach at the college level. I think there's like 25 of us right now, which is really cool. And it's really that. It's the creating opportunities for students. It's not saying, well, I'm the professor, so I'm going to go do this myself because, you know, that's my gig. Like he always says, he already has a job. Now it's time to help you get yours. So you need the experience of doing this. And so, you know, that's something that I feel like you can even do sort of at the secondary level, maybe middle or high school or something like that. You know, you got a high school thing coming up. Like maybe you have these little tiny committees where kids come together and design posters, you know, something a little like that. And it's the marketing side. And whenever you talk about middle and high school band, you know, band directors, as soon as you say something other than music, they're going to go, well, we don't have time for that. We still have to learn our instruments. And it's like, we're talking about something that these kids could do at home. They would love to do. It would give them a little bit more ownership, perhaps, in their program by being part of it in a different, unmusical way, where they feel like they're really helping to put this thing together. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a learning opportunity where you could have the kids be part of that. You could say, hey, you know, this year for the holiday concert or whatever, we're going to go to this children's home. I want to have a committee of kids that, you know, of our leaders within the band that maybe want to raise their hand and you guys can help put this thing together and we can sit down and, you know, make an event out of it where they lead it. And, you know, again, I think a lot of times band directors get caught up, music or percussion instructors too, get caught up in this. Well, I teach music. I don't do all that other stuff. I don't need to be teaching those skills. And I think music, for most of our students that continue on to college and they major in something that's not music, like the musical thing that they've done is kind of over. Like that impact is kind of done now. You know what I mean? But I think that going through this kind of process and giving them these opportunities with communication and marketing and whatever it might be, can help them in lifelong ways, you know, no matter what their career path is going to be in college, or if they go straight to a career. I think that, you know, these experiences can help them there. One of the big kind of things that we talk about in high schools and around the country is this college and career ready concept. Have you guys heard of this?
No.
College and career ready?
Big here. Yeah.
Yeah. I've
not heard of it.
Like I did some work with a school here in Kentucky that, I mean, like they have like automobile bays and stuff. It's kind of like home ec, but like on a bigger scale. Like they have automobile bays for people that know they may not want to go to college, but they want to do something more practical. So they have all these more practical kind of things that you could do for if you want to go into a career right after school and not go to college. But of course, the school is also gearing students that are interested in going into college for doing so. So anyway, we have this concept at the school level where it's college and career ready, but I don't feel like the band is really helping with that. I think it's just kind of, let's do some music just to do music. And I mm-hmm. feel like, you know, these opportunities could really align themselves to that college and career readiness. Mm-hmm. Am I making sense?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And also, I think that the students, you know, backing up just a little bit to what you said, I think it, the more the students are involved, the more that they do, whether it's high school or collegiate level or whatever level, the more invested they are in the performance, you know, the more they talk about it outside, the more that you know, they feel proud of presenting this. They feel like they're a part of something. And of course, I'm sure they feel that way when they're playing as well. But if they have another responsibility of making it happen, that, you know, they're more invested in it that way. I think it's really cool.
Sure.
Yep. I will say there's a certain irony to being a college professor and you get like a kid's, you know, transcript or whatever, and it says that they're not college ready. I've had that happen here. It's like, well, then why are they here?
This is like a program that they pass through in high school.
In Texas, they have like, I guess it's almost like a certification. Like if they pass off their tests with some level or something like that, they're considered college ready. Here, if they are not college ready, I think they have like a remedial kind of like study skills course they take almost to get mm-hmm. college ready. But yeah. I just wanted to kind of mention, like, tag along to what Brandon said about like how many high school students actually have the experience of presenting a concert in any way other than just showing up at the call time and performing. I don't think that high school students are generally given any sort of say over, and this might be, you know, partially a good thing because the teacher is the expert, but they don't have any say in their programming or how the printed programs look or what the posters look like or anything like that. And these are all things the teacher might take on that are a huge task that it could actually save time by having students do them and just approving them.
I'm sorry, I just want to interject. And I think maybe importantly too, is that oftentimes these things get neglected because the teacher doesn't have time to do them.
Yeah. But then like one thing that bothered me about my previous institution I taught at, was they had a recording studio and they had a commercial music program, and the students got to record for their, you know, degree projects or whatever, but the students didn't own anything they recorded. They couldn't even use it as like a demo for, you know, submitting to a record company or something like that. Which to me would be like studying, you know, Khan variations with Svet, and then Svet telling me when I leave, you can't use anything that I taught you about Khan variations when you perform it. It just seemed really odd. And this book, The Innovators, that I read, it talked about the two founders of Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. Google was basically their like graduate thesis project at Stanford. And if they hadn't been able to use that, it, like, their degree would have been worthless. So yeah, it really bothers me when we do have these skills that are in a college curriculum, but then the college wants to take ownership of them and not let the students use their own materials.
I'd imagine that's also an issue maybe in the sciences as well. You know, the research that people do, whether it's psychology or like some sort of chemistry or something.
Yeah.
Like,
my brother has dealt with that specifically.
Yeah. He's an engineer. In our lab. And Bill Gates did that too. And Bill Gates basically admits that he stole this stuff from Harvard.
Yeah.
He stole their resource time.
Well, and it's so sad because I would be interested in kind of looking into these things that say like, well, this new Harvard research says blank. It's like, well, was it Harvard research or was it a student that actually did the top to bottom development of that?
Yeah.
And they just took the credit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not to use Harvard as any sort of specific example for any reason, but you know, it's just kind of sad. It's like institution taking over the stuff, just like you said with the SPED example, that really doesn't make sense. These are opportunities to put your institution forward and not stuff.
Because I actually wanted to record some stuff at FAU, but they told me if that they recorded it there, it was theirs. And like, I couldn't use it on YouTube or anything. I was like, forget that.
Yeah. That's what Boston Conservatory said. Anyway, to go back for just a second to the like the idea of students getting all these different types of skills and experiences, especially in high school. Like, it's odd. I think I had all of that, but I did not get it from the band. I got it from my choir director, who I knew even at the time was really outstanding. Mm-hmm. Her name was Becky Thomas. We called her BT. But we would do, I think, 4 or 5 concerts a semester as high school students. And we would learn a lot of rep for something and then kind of vote on what we were going to do. When it came to a Christmas show, we would find maybe like 20 different tunes, and then we would write a script that strung them all together that cool. always had like pop culture references from the last few months. And like, it was really great for us, you know, and we had to do the whole fundraising things, and we had to show up to school at 7:15 in the morning to be able to do all this because there wasn't time in the regular day. Yeah, and you know, and then we would do the normal things like go to festival and try to get ones and blah-de blah-de. But she also, like, I remember I was the accompanist in choir for like a year, and I learned how to read an open score as a high school student. And then she said, all right, why don't you be the secondary rehearsal director? So if I need to go deal with something else, you conduct the group.
Huh. Were you allowed to use that knowledge after you graduated high school, or did she make you turn that into
proprietary? Oh, yeah. No. No, but I feel like, and she was able to, I mean, people that were her students, that she had 3 levels of choir, and if you auditioned and got into the second, everybody wanted to audition and be in the top choir, even though that meant you've got 7:15 mornings now. Mm-hmm. All year. But people wanted to do that. And she had this ability, even though she was like a total nut at times. And we would catch her in her office eating coffee grounds. Like, she was insane.
Cool.
She's a nut. But she had this ability to like see students and to be like, I think you're going to do this. So I'm going to give you all this responsibility on top mm-hmm. of what I'm presenting to everyone as these extra things. And mm-hmm. yeah, I was sitting here and I was wondering, like, I wonder why I didn't get that in the band. And then I mean, you know, how much of a focus of a semester in band as a high school kid is like, learn the marching show and make it really good. And who cares if you actually read well or understand these concepts? We just want it to look like you know what you're doing really well so we can win the competition.
Yeah, and it's about ego.
Yeah, and it's ego, and it's so much like worrying about a result, which this connects to like my previous topic about motivation. It's, yeah, so dependent on how is it going to turn out at the end that it's like, yeah, it's no wonder that we feel like there's no time because... Like, I don't think it's correct to focus solely, what felt like solely as a student. It probably wasn't, but it felt like that in band a lot of the time.
God, this is making me just remember how much I hate giving grades. I hate grades. It's the end of the semester.
Oh, we have to terrible. Do that.
It's just awful. The worst.
It seems like it depends on the culture, you know? I know I've been one of those... you know, solo and ensemble judges before, and certain places it seems like it's the culture is right. In bad places where I think the culture is wrong, they, you know, the student finishes playing, and I want to like teach them something. I remember one particular day where there were like 2 different little groups, and we had all this time blocked off, and I wanted to teach them. I was like, okay, nice job, you guys. Let's like try to start engaging them. And the parents interrupted me, and they said, oh, sorry, we got to go. Did they get a 1? Did they get a 1? And I said, well, I don't know. Maybe I got to look at the scores. But, you know, something that would help you with your playing, well, wait, did they get a 1? But did they get a 1? And I just said, sure. And they went, yes! Yeah!
It's so sad.
Literally, like literally, I laugh, the parents, but it's so sad. And these kids were in 6th grade or 7th grade, and I was just floored, you know. So yeah,
they got a 1, but they're not about to wink the Boston Symphony or anything here.
Well, right. I mean, that, I don't know what they're about to do. And I've had it similarly where, you know, a program, you know, hires you to teach after school, and of course the band director has all good intentions, wants you to teach them good stuff. The parents who are willing to pay for extra lessons are doing it for, you know, these 4 months, 3 months or something, a limited period of time, because they have state whatever's coming up. And the music is, we've talked about this before, the music is like absurdly too hard for these students. They can't read it. They can't read much of anything. And they're trying to play Cerrone 37 and Vic Firth Timpani A2 that's like all blasting way too hard for them. And they, you know, they're like, okay, this is what I have to play. Teach me how to do this. You're like, well, wait, let's just talk about reading music and let's go back. And the parents are like, do you think he's going to do it? How do you think he's going to do? How's the progress coming? And it's just like, dude, screw this. This is dumb. This isn't.
And it depends, though. You know, I had.
Cerrone 37 is pretty straightforward.
Ben, you're a good teacher. You're a good teacher.
Guys, I had a really good experience yesterday because we had our Allstate auditions yesterday. And I had a student that emailed me. I had given him a lesson like a week or two ago or something. And I ran into him at Allstate Day or at the Allstate auditions. I was like, oh, hey, how's it going? Like, how was your audition? He's like, oh, I haven't played yet. You know, I feel pretty good. Whatever. And then I was like, okay, great. Let me know how you do. He emailed me after the audition later that night and was like, I don't know how I did, but I felt really good how I played. And man, it was really cool to see so many good players there, you know, and just like, I don't care if I made it or not, but I felt really good. Thanks for the lesson, you know? So like, there definitely are kids that like that. And I think that us in the positions that we're in, can do a lot, you know, we have the opportunity to reach a lot of these students and a lot of the directors, and, you know, a lot of stuff that we say sticks with them. And so I think that it is really our obligation to not say, you know, not place so much emphasis on the competition, but rather the learning process and how it fits into the big picture. And of course the music itself. So I think as college teachers, it really is our responsibility to help take away the competition aspect of it.
So, it's the trophy kid problem, right? I mean, we're college students are old enough that you don't see them as trophy kids anymore, right? I mean, it's these psycho parents that should just. I mean, I remember having students in high school that were in ballet, percussion, guitar, orchestra, the football team. And the kid, I remember the student came to me and he just said, I said, oh, well, why didn't you get any practicing done? He's like, well, after ballet, I had to do this. Then after soccer, I had to do that. And there were all extracurricular activities. And I just said, like, oh, dude, well, do you want to take drum lessons? He said, like, well, I really don't. It's my parents. I said, that's cool, man. I'll call your mom. Tell her that this is done. You know, this is it's unethical, you know.
You know, I spend a lot of time like trying to dig down deep and figure out, like, okay, what is really the fundamental issue here? For why do we have these trophy kind of kids? Why is that a mentality? And I think it's just, you know, we lost sight of the journey being the important part. You know what I mean? It's not about the learning process. It's just about the end result. And of course, we all know that standardized testing has put such pressure on everybody, from the teachers to administration to students especially, and parents and everything else. So, you know, one thing that I found to help alleviate that in a meaningful musical way is improvisation. I actually just submitted a thing to Ben Stiers yesterday for the Education Companion the PAS puts out on
Ben
improv.
Stein.
Ben Stein. Yeah.
Cool.
on how to use improv in, say, a middle or a high school program. Just to get back to creativity and discovery in a musical sense. You know, because standardized testing teaches teachers basically to be robots. You know, my wife's a first grade teacher, and that's basically what's happened to her. You know, she goes to school and she gets, you know, these degrees in teaching and everything else. And then when she arrives, they're like, well, here's your big box curriculum that you have to go do. And everything is spelled out. You can't be creative at all as an educator. You got to do exactly what's going on here. You know what I mean? And so that gets passed down to the student too, where teachers, kind of like what we saw in Atlanta, when was that, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, maybe longer, with the cheating scandal? It's like teachers are in such a position to get students to succeed, because student success and graduation rates equals funding. And if your class is undergraduating people or under preparing people, then you're the problem and you get canned. So there's that pressure on teachers to get the kids to improve. No, so a lot of times that's giving the kid the answer and cheating the system of trying to discover the answer. You know what I mean? The process. Yeah. And not really understanding how to do something. But let's just make sure you write the right thing so that we can move on to the next thing that we have pressure to do. And so I feel like musically we do a lot of that same kind of stuff. And so I feel like improv is a really great way of breaking every one of those walls down so that a kid is the one that's developing what's happening. They don't have to read something that, you know, somebody wrote. They don't have to play a certain way that they're being told to play. They don't have to do anything in particular. It's like, dude, just take this conga and do something. Like, just figure out, like, your voice. You know, do something. Yeah. And every time that I start this with a new group of kids, of course they stand there and they laugh at each other. They giggle because they have no idea what to do. And that's just how kids, like, handle it. They just giggle at each other and they laugh. And they think it's stupid for a second. So then I jump in and improv with them a little bit and kind of show them that it's okay to fail, right? Because there's no right or wrong answer in improv. They're always looking for that right answer, which is why they giggle. But this is a great way to figure out how to, you know, get your own voice, discover how to do something new, create on your own. And every time I do this, the students, like I said, they giggle at first, and then they start seeing their friends and their peers do it, and it sounds cool, sounds like something. They feel like they've succeeded a little bit. And, you know, I'll come in the next week, and the kids are there at 7:30 in the morning on their own, improvising either by themselves or with friends. I'll come in the band room after school, and they're there improvising, you know? Like, they really kind of fall in love with that process of just creating and doing something that has no rules, because literally everything else in their life is rule-based.
Yeah.
Yeah. I look forward to reading that article. That sounds great.
Well, yeah, I hope it's clear.
I just want to kind of, like, highlight something. I think Brandon kind of hit the nail on the head, and that is that in so many words, I feel like we often, like, we have a standardized goal that we create for students, and some students aren't able to achieve that goal, and other students could achieve so much more, but by creating this standardized goal somewhere in the middle, it just kind of, if I can make a word, mediocrizes everything. So yeah, I think that that's really true. Like, it's a delicate balance in education, I know, because you have to hold people to a standard, but then also I just think that standard can get so lame. And like the all district etude pieces or whatever, it's just, I just hate it.
Well, you know, that's a different conversation I was going to bring up whenever you're talking about the Cerrone, but now I lost what I was going to say. Actually, I'll say that about the Cerrone. How do we get to that point? How do we get to the point where the students are apparently not learning to read or play their instrument with any sort of musical or technical facility. But then for some reason, somebody somewhere decided that Delacluse 1 was going to be the senior all-state piece, you know? And there's obviously not a lot of quality instruction going on because most of the students that walk in the door have no idea how to approach this piece. And it's clearly over their head. How do we get to that point? Are we just graduating a lot of percussion instructors that can't teach? Or, I don't know. Yeah. Am I making sense in my question?
Well, I personally think it's what you started this whole bit with, which was competition first, education second, which I think we all, you know, is pretty universally agreed upon that we just don't want to see, you know, we want education, not grades, not competition, not winning or losing. I want to go all the way back to something we started with a good 15, 20 minutes ago about, you were saying, give students opportunities to learn other life skills, like leadership things. And we've been talking about, band keeps coming up. And I just want to say here, man, we have a huge band. It's like 430 or something ridiculously big, and it's great. And it's a real positive thing here for sure. And our band director, I think, does a wonderful job getting the students into leadership roles. And, you know, of course it takes up their time. And sometimes we're like, oh shoot, I wish you practiced more, but you were doing this thing. But man, when I see them in action,
it's what you said. I think they're really learning those types of extra talents that they need. Mm-hmm. And something I'm doing this semester I wanted to share with you guys real quick is we got a bunch of graphic scores from a colleague of mine in the graphic design program, and she produced those for us this semester, and we've been just started working on them. The students are all, or not all the students, but a bunch of them are writing graphic score interpretations, and man, they're cool. Really beautiful scores. Whoa. that these guys came up with. So these are the scores from the class that you're seeing here, and yeah, I was just so blown away with what she was able to, of course, educate them on with graphic notation. And we just basically found a time where we could get all the percussionists and all of her students in the same room at the same time. And we just gave them a nice, like, overview of, you know, like the history of graphic notation and just basically what it is and the stuff.
Did you show them the Mark Applebaum? Was it the Metaphysics of Notation?
Yeah. 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 Actually, she showed it to him first, believe it or not. She beat me to it. I, of course, just showed them some of my music and just tried to sell mallets to them all.
But Casey, you had them interpret the scores and play them, I assume?
So yeah, that's what I was getting to. So we're working on that now. And part of the how this plays into the leadership conversation is I'm trying to really let them run their own rehearsals. And on one hand, it's great because I have a sophomore who's doing his best to tell my DMA student what to do, you know,
and, right.
And he gets that, my DMA gets that, everyone else gets that. And man, that's a tough thing for him to learn. You know, I mean, that's not exactly an easy, thing to balance and figure out how to do. So on one hand, I get that it's so important that they really see and understand this and have that experience. But I understand if some teachers aren't patient enough to go through it, because it can be, you know, I mean, it can be kind of painful watching them do it, you know, rehearsal is going at 2 miles an hour and you've got 20 minutes left. And it's like, right. Oh man, if I just took hold of this, it could go so much faster. If I just had my DMA student take hold of this, it would go so much faster. So, you know,
well, I mean, that's when you throw a DMA student in the room just to basically be a silent observer and then just kind of guide the ball down the lane, you know what I mean? And just like, here's one bit of advice, and now you go for another 20 minutes without them saying anything. But
yeah.
You know, yeah. I kind of felt that way. I'll be honest, like when I got the UK, I didn't feel like I had those opportunities that I got once I got to Kentucky. I didn't have... As a master's student, I didn't necessarily feel like I had the opportunity to take a leadership role in the sense of like helping to, I don't want to say run the studio, but you know, be a leader within the studio that way. I felt like everybody was pretty much an even keel student. You know, in my undergraduate years, partly being naive and young and not really knowing any better, but I saw the doctoral students as kind of leaders, but I didn't really see them every day. So I kind of thought that they were more like professors, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was kind of the vibe of the program, was just like, there were, at least that's how I took it, that there was this inherent sort of hierarchy. You know, you're an undergrad, so, you know, kind of not really what do you know, so you can't contribute. That wasn't it at all, but it was just, I don't know, kind of a little bit of a top-down thing. Oh, and sure. Then when I came to Kentucky, it was very much everybody's just sort of on the same level. I mean, really kind of a bottom-up approach. Like, what does the student need? Okay, that's what I'm going to give them. You know, and that's why those opportunities were presented, and I thought that was great. You know, I had to do a lot of growing up myself, and kind of taking that new dynamic, that new approach that, like, the doctoral student should probably be listening to the freshmen if they got something to say that is meaningful. You know what I mean? It's like, don't be too big for your britches or whatever you want to say. But do people still say that? I don't know.
Yeah. That's all people say anymore.
That's all they say.
That's that comment that got Donald Trump in so much trouble.
Oh, that one. That's the one.
Yeah.
but yeah, you know, I think that bottom-up approach, we're seeing it in a lot of other areas, not just academia, not just school, but you know, you're seeing it in businesses that are maybe employee-owned businesses where the employees are the ones to help guide the business down the road and make decisions for what goes on. Yeah. They get paid well. You know, the business is doing things that make them happy. You know, look at Silicon Valley. You know, you get to nap and drink beer at the job, and you can, like, work at home. And if that's your best environment to get work done, be productive, then that's cool with us. You know what I mean?
Man, Steve Snowden was drinking a beer on the podcast. I have to put like a parental Steve. Advisory now.
Steve, that's funny. Cool.
Yeah, I just wanted to share one kind of like funny anecdote from my experience at Miami. The way that Svet does the percussion ensemble is he does like small chamber groups, like a trio, quartet, something like that. And the group rehearses twice a week on their own. And then the third rehearsal, he comes in and, you know, coaches the group. And I like the term coaching because it's not like he's teaching or telling what to do. But it can be frustrating when you feel like you don't have enough help, because we did John Sothis's Kyoto, and I remember we learned it and we kept on rehearsing it, and like no matter what we did, it just still sounded terrible. And we had like five people in the room, everyone throwing out every suggestion they could think of, and it still was awful. Then I don't remember exactly what the breakthrough was, but Svet came and helped us. So yeah, I think it is, it's, I mean, and obviously that's why you have a teacher there, but it's a mix of student leadership and sage advice from a, you know, wise coach that produces results.
And that's, of course, the thing I see. It's like, okay, I want to let this student try to feel out what it's like to control this little 30 minutes they have to produce their graphic score interpretation that they've written out. But at the same time, you have to kind of monitor, like, okay.
Yeah, well, and I think the key was that Svet never watched our rehearsals. Like, they were entirely on our own because it would be a waste of his time to sit there and watch us try and figure it out. You know what I mean?
But, well, see, that's also a teaching moment, though. You know, you don't have to tell the student exactly what to do now, but you can give them an idea of, okay, of how to be in your mind. Like, me as a teacher, this is what I'm considering, and this is why I choose, or I would think that we should do this next. You know what I mean? Give them the behind the scenes of your decision making, of why you make a decision. So that the next time they approach a similar situation, they know how to think about it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Rather than just like come in and overhaul and just say, hey, go do this with no real understanding for why.
Hey, well, this is really awesome and really great thoughts. And I almost hate to stop or diverge from it because I think it's going really nice. But we do have a Facebook question. It's a totally different topic. So maybe we just hit it real quick. And then we'll kind of move towards wrapping. And of course, now I can't find it. Let's see. It's from a high school student.
Casey, I have a few if you can't find it.
Oh, I just found it. Thanks, Ben. It's from Benjamin Holt. He says, my question is, what is the number one musical skill major symphony orchestras look for in people who audition on percussion and or timpani? That's tough to answer.
Yeah. So I'll tell you that Ben is actually a student of mine. He's out in Utah. He was a timpanist actually at the Battalion Drum and Bugle Corps, which is based out of the Salt Lake City area, which is a brand new group going into our second year of open class.
That's the hood, man. That's where I'm from.
Yeah, it's right. Rough. Dude. I'm going there next week actually for a camp. But yeah, you know, to answer Ben's question as if he were here, I don't know specifically, and I will say because I haven't taken those auditions, I haven't put myself in that position at a major orchestra, but what I could tell you, it's a musician and professional, would be, you know, some of the basic stuff. I mean, you know, the musical interpretation. Do you sound like you're playing the music? If you're going to play Scheherazade on the snare drum or something like that, you know, does it sound like you're playing with the clarinet part? And I think that's true for timpani as well. Like, do you just sound like you're playing with the orchestra? Or do you just sound like you're playing excerpts? Everybody always says, like, well, you got to know you got to know the committee that's in the room, which is primarily not going to be other percussionists, but it could be a violinist. It could be a trombone player or something like that. And so knowing that those people are sitting in the panel and they're listening to you play, they need to hear their part in their head as you perform. Does that make sense? They got to hear that you fit with what they have in their head, your musical decisions and sensitivity and that sort of thing. Mm.
Just to hop on board a little bit, it's probably hard to say what's the one thing, because of course it's kind of a cocktail of ingredients that they want. But I would say for him, you're in high school, that's something you want to work towards. Definitely one of those ingredients is being able to nail it, and being able to nail all of them. There's so many of them. The list is so big. So yeah, I guess I'm a believer in these, little short-term goals of advice. And yeah, I guess mine, if you're listening, Ben, would be, man, just work on nailing them for now.
Yeah. And put yourself in a position where you're learning from people that have done those things. You know, sure. You go to a conservatory that's taught by people that have taken in one major symphony timpani auditions. I think that would be the best answer, you know. Like I said, I haven't done that, so I can't necessarily tell you what the panel's doing.
It's a pretty normal thing across the orchestral community nowadays to just buy two pairs of every Cangelosi marimba mallet.
I heard that works.
Yeah, I've heard that. This just seems to be what people are doing. That really seems to be the direction, if you will, that the scene is going. And yeah, so I don't know what they do with them, but they definitely buy them.
A balance and glockenspiel.
Sound great. Sound amazing.
I had a friend that recently took a somewhat major symphony orchestra audition, percussion section, not timpani. But he said that there were some incredible number of people in the hundreds that showed up for this thing, of course. And in the first round, it was like almost everybody got cut except for, just a small handful, as if they already knew what they wanted. And I would say, from a psychological standpoint or a professional standpoint down the road, it's like, just play how you play.
Yeah.
I talked to this person and he talks saying, I don't know what the committee wants. So I don't know how to really perform it. And it's like, dude, don't do what, in my perspective, don't do what the committee wants. Like, do what you do. And if it's a good fit, then cool. And if it's not, then that's okay too. Because if you win the job doing what you think the committee wants, you're going to constantly have that burden of like trying to appease somebody else in their musical interpretation. And if that's not true to you, then it's, I think there's a conflict there.
Yeah. Like, what did you win? Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
Well, this is the second week now where we said we'd start contributing these little quotes that Laurel finds. And I said that the way we would use them is if there was a lull in the episode. But again, two in a row, there was no lull. So hopefully we can just keep that going and the quote will be pushed all the way to the end. So what do you have for us, Laurel?
Yeah, what I've got for you today is by one of today's most famous, if not most famous, cellists. So I'll let you guys guess at the end who you think this is. He says, "I tend to think of cellists as nice people. There's less of a demand for us than for violinists or pianists. We're not sought after, so the image is different. Most of us have played in orchestras. We play a lot of chamber music. We have to work with other people all the time." So sounds probably the familiar. Most famous living cellist. Who do you think?
Yo-Yo Ma.
Yo-Yo!
Oh, shoot. It's not Luigi Boccherini, 1743-1805? Google didn't work.
Yeah, that's so relative to us as percussionists, though, Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. And one of my new duo partners was in Civic in Chicago, and Yo-Yo is there all the time. And she says he's just this amazing, amazing person.
That's awesome.
Yeah, just warm and open. And
well, all I've ever heard, and if you hear the story more than once, it's true, from different places. But, he'll show up at, super high level school of music, and yeah, they work on all the heavy stuff, and it's really, really high level. Or he'll show up at a high school And the kids are, you know, they say, what are those things on the page? He's like, oh, great. Let's talk about whole notes and half notes. That sounds wonderful. Let's talk about the basics. And he's just as happy to talk about one versus the other. And
amazing.
Yeah, it sounds like he's a really special dude. Well,
cool. Well, let's try to get him on a podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of upcoming people, I'm trying to keep, you know, letting you guys know who's up and coming so that maybe you can listen to who they are ahead of time. So the next person is Elizabeth Blair, and she runs a podcast called Listening to Ladies that highlights female composers. So I hope our listeners can check her out and maybe check out her website. I was really impressed. I listened to all the episodes. I was actually mowing the lawn, and I listened to all of her episodes all in a row. I really enjoyed it.
That's a big con.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Sorry, what?
It's a big lawn.
Her episodes are, it is a big lawn, but her episodes are much shorter and more focused than ours. So, no, it wasn't so bad. But yeah, listeningtoladies.com, we'll have Elizabeth Blair, and then followed by Tom Burrett, and then Stephen Schick, I believe is the order. So, man, Brandon Arve, thanks so much for joining us. That was a really, really blast.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
Megan. Thanks for having me.
Hey, yeah, man, you are very welcome. And I look forward to seeing you again whenever that might be. So, Laurel, yeah. Megan, Ben, thanks so much as always. And catch you guys later.
Sounds good. Bye.
See ya.